he went to Constantinople. Now, this really is Constantinople, and it's probably about a century after he was there, but looking for a map of the same period that he was is maddening. So, but he went to Constantinople to finish his studies at the School of Philosophy in Constantinople. He studied classical literature, and he studied philosophy, and he began to move in humanist circles. And so we have someone who's got a strong spiritual foundation, who's a spiritual sort of grandchild of St. Gregory Palamas, and yet he's involved in humanist education. But he never lost his faith. And so he was sort of blending the two. And while he was in Constantinople, actually, the dispute between St. Gregory Palamas and Barlaam erupted. And so that was the Hesychast controversy. That was a controversy over God's essences and energies. It was a controversy over whether the light of Tabor was created or uncreated. It was a controversy over if we can really be united with God. And Cabasilos was there. He was on the side of Palamas. And he was really captivated by the idea that humans and God could be joined together. This idea of theosis, of divinization. And so he was captivated by this idea. But he still maintained his secular education. He still was concerned with the social and political problems of his times. And so we have this man of great faith who was involved in really the political controversies of his time. This is really a tough thing. It's a tough thing. But it's fun, it's exciting. You had the emperor. The emperor was Andronicus III. Andronicus III Palaiologos. And he had really worked hard to sort of create peace amongst sort of the outlying invaders. So he created peace with the Serbs. He had created peace with the Turks. And so the empire was sort of stable for a little bit. But Andronicus III was old. At that time, he was old. He was 60, 61, which back then was old. Today, I mean, you know, 60 is the new 30. Yeah. Seriously. But, you know, they didn't have Kaiser. So, you know, it was different. It was difficult. And he died. And he died without leaving an heir. He had a son. He had a 9-year-old son when he died. If you think about that, if he was 61 and he had a 9-year-old son, well, maybe 60 was a new 30 back then, too. And so he had, this is Andronicus III, Palaiologos, and he had an advisor, John Katakozanos. And imagine him without the imperial clothes, because he was just an advisor. He was a trusted advisor. And you know, he was the kind of advisor that went with the emperor everywhere. And so if the emperor was going to negotiations, John Kantakouzenos would go with him. If he was going to battle, John Kantakouzenos would go with him. And so he was like such a trusted advisor. So he had his 9-year-old son, and he had this trusted advisor. When the two of them would go off, they would appoint a third man, Alexios Apokavkos. Yes, I can't even read my own writing. So Alexios, when the two of them were gone, they would leave Alexios in charge. Andronicus III dies. The 9-year-old is really too young to take over. He knows very well, John Kantakouzenos knows very well the workings of the empire, and the late emperor's friends are his friends. He's negotiated with them, so he's in a perfect position. But Alexios said, you know what? When you left, you always left me in charge, so I'm the one who's the rightful heir. So you really had two or three people fighting to be emperor. John Cantacuzenus, and this could just be historians, but everyone's pretty much united, he wanted the 9-year-old son to be emperor. But he knew that a 9-year-old couldn't run the empire. So he said, I will run the empire until he's old enough to take over. And he came up with a great plan. He said, I'm going to wait until he gets a little bit older, and then when he's maybe 17 years old, crown him, and it will be co-emperors together. And then when he gets older, you know, 25 or so, then I'll retire, and he'll be sole emperor. So he had this whole sort of transition scheme worked out, but Alexios would have nothing to do with it. Alexios was stirring the people up against Cantacuzenus, and it turned the whole empire, Constantinople and Thessalonica, into a civil war zone. And it was a crazy thing, because Alexios talked to the poorer people and got them riled up against the richer people, so it turned into class warfare, where the poor folk were attacking the rich folk and sacking houses and burning them, and it was all kinds of craziness. And Cavassilus was in the middle of this, and he was an imperial worker. He was sort of a civil servant. He was running around in imperial circles, and so he knew John Cantacuzenus, and he supported him. But he was in this horrible place, and these horrible things were happening. And even in Thessalonica, the city was torn apart by the zealots, who revolted against imperial power and the elite. Cavassilus went to Thessalonica and negotiated a peace treaty. And he brought peace to Thessalonica. And that was a great thing. And he became a diplomatic representative of Cantacuzenus. So, I mean, that's kind of a big deal. So, Nicholas Cavassilus was a diplomat, was an ambassador for the emperor. It's kind of a high-ranking post. Then, when Cantacuzenus became emperor, I don't even know why that's there. We're going to go back to this one. When Cantacuzenus became emperor, he called Cavassilus to Constantinople to be one of his primary counselors. So Nicholas, St. Nicholas Cavassilus was one of the primary counselors of the emperor of Constantinople. That's a big deal. And again, when we think about holy people, we don't really think about them as being top-level counselors to heads of state. So he was having all these kinds of experiences. And he was influential on the emperor, both politically, he gave him very shrewd political advice, but also spiritually. And so the emperor decided, you know what, the time is going to come, I'm going to retire, I'm going to be a monk. And that sort of piety certainly came from the emperor, but it was nurtured by St. Nicholas Cavassilus, who was one of his trusted. So, I mean, if you just think about that, that's kind of crazy. And it's like, you know, one of the president's cabinet sort of counseling him spiritually, and then he decides that he wants to go off and become a monk after his term is over. So Cavassilus was a really interestingly positioned person. And so when we think of saints, we don't usually think about that. Yeah.
I was just curious what happened to the other guy that was making trouble.
Yeah.
He flared, and eventually in 1351, he was out of the picture. You know what? I wish I remember what happened here. I think we're going to talk a little bit more, because it's going on. It's an ongoing problem in the Byzantine Empire. So in 1347, Cavassilus, St. Nicholas, was part of the official party to escort St. Gregory Palamas to Thessalonica for his enthronement as archbishop. So, Gregory Palamas in Constantinople, elected archbishop of Thessalonica. He goes over to Thessalonica to be enthroned, to become archbishop. St. Nicholas Cavassilis goes as part of his retinue, you know, part of his group, and they get to Thessalonica, and the city is still in an uproar. The city is still being ripped apart by this political sort of a thing. And you know what? I'm reading this, and it makes me realize that maybe Washington, D.C. didn't create political problems. I'm reading this, and I'm thinking maybe what's going on in Washington, D.C. is kind of tame, you know, compared to this. You know? Just riots were going on. Things were burning, and the Archbishop couldn't even enter the city. So, what do? He and Nicholas went to Mount Athos for a couple of years to wait until
things calmed down.
And so finally in 1349, 2 years after he was elected, St. Gregory Palamas was enthroned as Archbishop of Thessalonica. And so 1351, 2 years after that, a council headed by John Cantacuzenos proclaimed hesychasm an official doctrine of the church. And so hesychasm is, as everyone knows, that technique of inner prayer. It's a technique, and here's the deal. When we think hesychasm, I think a lot of times we don't really think about what hesychasm really was at the time. I think we think of, I've got my little prayer robe, and I say the Jesus prayer, you know? And so for maybe 20 minutes, I say the Jesus prayer. Someone did a study to get a PhD in psychology on people saying the Jesus prayer when they go to the dentist's office. And so I think a lot of times we think of the Jesus prayer, or hesychasm, in a very sort of watered down version.
Forgive me, but I think there may be some people here who don't even know that term at all.
Hesychasm means peace, prayer, isahia, calmness. And, oh my goodness, we have in the Bible, pray without ceasing. And that's always a goal of the human. Constantly invoking the name of Jesus. And here's the deal. Let's think about working out. Let's just think about it. Let's not do it. Let's just think about it. And, you know, if you're going to be healthy, you know, you need to walk, you need to be active. And so we've got that concept of be active. But then people say, well, I really want to be active. And so they come up with some idea of, okay, that means I need to walk 3 miles a day. And then I need to walk 5 miles a day. Let's think about people say, oh, I need to eat healthy. Okay, it goes from a concept to an exact thing. I need to eat X number of calories a day. I need to cut down on carbs. I need to cut down on fat. You know, I can have only so many grams of this. And it goes from a concept to a practice. And I mean, seriously, I know some people who bring out their little scales and weigh their food because I'm supposed to have 4 ounces of red meat or 4 ounces of chicken breast. You know, heaven forbid it's 4.5 ounces or 3.8 ounces. So it becomes very regulated. And so hesychasm is, properly speaking, a method that came up in the monastics' lives, and it was really perfected on Mount Athos, where it was a very specific method of prayer. And the Philokalia, oh my goodness, there's this thing that I make my poor students read. Patriarch Callistus and Ignatius of Santopoulos, Directions to Hesychasm in 100 Chapters. And so from page 164 to page 270, so we're talking about 110 pages on how to pray. And it's very, very sort of, you go into a dimly lit room, you don't have any icons around you. You sit down on a low stool, you bow your head, you focus really on this part of your body, you control your breath. And the Hesychasts wanted to cut out all distractions. They wanted to open themselves to the infinite God. And the Hesychasts would say, you don't want an icon, you don't want to picture an icon in your head because you're limiting Christ. So Hesychasm is very hardcore in its purest form. And remember how I said they practiced the Jesus prayer, and I said the wording is important? They practiced the Jesus prayer. Hesychasm was something for the monks, something for the really hardcore monks. The monks would sort of go off and do this, and that would be their vocation. So Hesychasm sort of settled this, on the one hand, this controversy over, is it possible for humans to be united with God? And the church said, yes, it is possible for humans to be united with God. And this way of praying is a legitimate way of doing that. Because some people were saying, you know what, that's a little too hardcore, we don't know. But the church did it. And actually, at this council, they also got rid of, remember the third guy, Alexios, who wanted to be the emperor. This council got rid of him and said, goodbye. And then, a couple years later, we've got John V Palaiologos, and the 9-year-old kid is now 20 years old. This is probably later. He's 20 years old, and he said, I'm ready to be emperor. And John Cantacuzeno said, you know what? You're not ready for it. And he says, well, I'm going to take it. And so the 20-year-old co-emperor decided, I'm going to take over. So he declared himself full emperor. He declared John Cantacuzeno to be out. And things always just sort of, it's dominoes. The empire was government and church together, and so John V Palaiologos not only took over as sole emperor, he also kicked the patriarch out, because the patriarch was a friend of Cantacuzenos, and he installed Saint Philotheos Kokinos as patriarch. This is great. Do you know about, like, at the beginning, before liturgy, how the priest cuts the bread out and arranges it on the proskomidi, the preparation of the gifts? This is crazy. That ritual of preparation of the bread and the wine was introduced, imposed on the church, instituted officially under Saint Philotheos Kokinos. So, I mean, the liturgy is still evolving in this way, and something that we just think of as part of the liturgy was a new thing, and was part of this whole hubbub. Patriarch Callistus was deposed, and the job was offered to Nicholas Kavassilis. Nicholas Kavassilis says, you know what? I don't think it's the smartest idea to do. Thanks, but no thanks. And so Philotheos Kokinos went in. And it was definitely not a smart thing to do, because the army still supported John Cantacuzenos. The army said, you are our emperor. And so they took him back into Constantinople. Philotheos Kokinos was out. Callistus was back in. Then eventually Callistus died. Philotheos Kokinos came back. And I think it's really kind of interesting that we had two patriarchs that were kind of like in and out, and they're both venerated as saints in the church. So even though people get caught up in horrible political games, well, they can still be saints.